Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. All week long, we're hearing from Black Iowans talking about their stories, their experiences, and ideas. Today, we're going to talk about the power of art as a tool for self-expression, inspiration, education, and empathy building. I'll talk with Teresa Zilk of Des Moines about the power of storytelling, and rapper and entrepreneur Mark Hayes about how he found his voice through music. My first guest today is Caleb Rainey. He is a poet, spoken word artist, educator, and activist. He performs as the Negro Artist and has published two collections of poetry, Look Black Boy and Heart Notes. He's also the founder and program director for IC Speaks, a high school spoken word program in Iowa City, and he is on the line with me now. And Caleb, we have been talking a lot this week about the power of protest, the power of policy, community building. You want to talk about the power of art in this moment, in the Black Lives Matter movement. Tell me why.
Because I think art is often overlooked or downplayed in a way that it doesn't seem as important. And it's hard for me because as obviously a community organizer and a person who is fighting the good fight, I understand how important policy change is. But I also understand that art is the medium in which we change people individually. We change their heart and their minds. And so this seems like the time in which art seems so important. In a time when we are, as people, missing connection, art connects people, and then it also allows for us to like change ourselves and grow when we learn something and feel something new.
Do you feel like you have made more of a difference with your poetry than you have through the community organizing and the work that you've done?
I would say it is, for me personally, more rewarding, but I don't know if I've done more work. I think I can point to more people that I've changed their minds through my poetry than more policies that I can say I changed. And also the losses just feel a lot different. I as a community organizer, and, you know, if you hold a strike or a protest in City Hall during one of their meetings and like that kind of thing, oftentimes you can still be brushed aside and or escorted out or whatever, and you take that loss and it feels like an L that's really heavy and really big because you had this one moment, where art allows us like this moment of continual growth together, continual conversation and discussion. It's not just everything waiting for this one moment or this one policy or this one thing to change.
I want to talk about art in this moment, too, because we have seen, I mean, particularly with visual artists, we've seen some really powerful images this summer after George Floyd was killed by a Minneapolis police officer. For example, there's the George Floyd mural in Minneapolis, which has become such an iconic vision.
Oh, yeah.
What do you see when you look at that?
For me, it's putting a name and a face, which we constantly have struggles doing as a society for Black people, is giving them humanity. And so this artistry allows you to really see a person, an image. And when I say George Floyd, you can have an image in your head, whether you'd watched the actual footage or not, right? Like, you now have at least something that you hold on to that is a concrete image of a person, of a movement, right? Rather than this abstract idea, it becomes concrete and solid. And I think visual art does that really, really well. That is not only an entryway, but it is also a reminder, right? Like, it is a constant, you can't ignore that this conversation is happening, right? You'd have to close your eyes at this point, which I think is a big thing in the Midwest, in which we hide a lot, right? Like, we're really nice, and so we hide a lot of our true feelings, a lot of our true thoughts, and we don't really challenge them. But all of a sudden, you can't ignore it. Like, you have to at least have some kind of conversation about it. And that is one of the biggest things that starts the movement, right, is to just be talking about the problem.
I want to ask you about one of really, I think, the uglier things that happened this summer.
in Iowa City, where you are, there were many protests, and mm-hmm. along with the protests was quite a lot of tagging or creating graffiti. Mm-hmm. And one night, graffiti was applied, I guess, to the statue of Niall Kinnock outside Kinnock Stadium mm-hmm. and on the hospital. And there was such an uproar after that.
Oh, yeah.
And part of this was so ugly because people who had not spoken out about the fact that Black people were getting murdered mm-hmm. were very upset about spray paint on property.
Yeah.
Is that art?
I vaguely describe art as self-expression, right? The expression of emotion and universal experience in many different mediums. But I would say that like specifically the graffiti is art. If we can look at a painting in which the artist seemingly just threw paint on a canvas and we can call that art, why can we not acknowledge that graffiti in which it has a very clear, distinct message is an art? It's that in it of itself is like a question that I have. But also, art is trying to start a conversation, and it did. It did have people either have to talk about, did they care about Niall Kinnock more than they did about the actual living people who are now getting killed and dying in our country, right? Which one do you care more about, a statue or a person, right? A building or a person, which one's more important? And it did force a lot of people to have that conversation, to have to acknowledge what they were okay with and what they weren't. But why? Why is the hospital building having marks on it? It's not like they destroyed the property and therefore it couldn't help people, right? Why does that then matter more than actual people dying? We've been dying. Please see that. Say something. Let's change that, and then you can have all of the cute buildings you want, as long as I get to live.
One of the things that I've heard from a number of artists that I know this summer was that they just didn't feel like they could create. There were, you know, so many horrible things happening, so much emotional strain that they weren't in a space to create. And we know, of course, that a lot of great art grows out of pain.
Mm.
But also, if you are trying to keep your head above water, it's hard to create. How have you been doing?
Whew. It's tough. It is heavy, especially after George Floyd. It was a moment of mourning. It was a time in which I couldn't write anything. And it was hard because I've been doing this work for a long time. And to just see so much feel like a repeat, and then also to be isolated via COVID, right? And also seeing that Black people are being disproportionately like affected by COVID too, right? Like that there's these battles on many fronts. It's tiring. It's hard. It's disheartening. And for me, creating has been a bit of a challenge. I've written a handful of new poems, but I know when I run into people who know that I'm an artist, they go, "Hey, so what have you been writing? Like, I bet you have a whole new book, right?" Like, it's like the joke that they make. And I'm thinking, no, I can some days barely get out of bed. Like, this is a heavy day. I'm taking on the world. Sometimes creating is taking even more out of me. That's hard to give.
I hope that many people listening have read your poetry, and you are so vulnerable in your poetry. Mm. Yet it sounds like this is even more vulnerable.
Yeah. I want to continue to create art that covers the whole Black experience, or at least my whole Black experience, I should say, because Black experience isn't a monolith. But the poem I want to share with you today is a little angry. It's, I think, arguably my angriest poem. And part of that comes from the fact that I've been doing this fight for so many years, being so vulnerable, and then acknowledging that there's still so much work to do. And sometimes we get angry and we get frustrated and we're PO'd. We're gosh darn it, I wish this was better. And that I'm trying now to also be more vulnerable even in that kind of pain and to share that anger, but go, anger is always a source of pain. Anger is the sign of something deeper that needs to be discussed. It is hard to be that honest and especially with strangers, it's kind of scary in a lot of ways. But the rewarding thing is when you choose to be open and vulnerable and you are accepted. And in most spaces, I have been accepted and taken in at least a little bit, and people going, I'm listening to you. I hear you. I'm glad you're sharing this with us.
Would you share your poem with us?
This poem is a violent protest. A raging riot set fire to your precincts, your clan sanctuary. Steal every piece of life from Target so that our deaths will be decked out in the decor of what's always been on our backs. Because didn't we always own Target? Weren't we always fresh to death? Isn't that an oxymoron like being black in America? Like this poem? Like expecting what you deserve from people who benefit from your death? I will not play peace as you play war. Which means these words will press its knee down on your perspective so that your bigotry cannot breathe. It will choke out every bit of privilege until you are calling out for your mama, and I will watch the ignorance fade from your eyes because I refuse to write another obituary. I have run out of words for grief. There is only room for anger now. It is the only thing that stops the crying. The backbone holding me upright when the world wants me face down on the ground. I'd rather die than live this way. So if I must die, let me die fighting. So yeah, there's that for you.
Caleb, thank you so much. And I hope that you take care. I hope you're finding space for yourself, too.
I'm trying. I've leaned on my support a lot, and I'm very blessed to have that.
Caleb Rainey, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Caleb Rainey is a poet, spoken word artist, educator, and activist. He performs as the Negro Artist, and he's published two collections of poetry, Look, Black Boy, and Heart Notes. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. In a moment, I'll talk with Teresa Zilk about the power of storytelling and rapper Marcaeus about the power of music. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
I cry for the sons without fathers.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week, listening to Black voices. All week long, we're hearing from Black Iowans, their stories, their experiences, their ideas. My next guest has also been giving Iowans an opportunity to share their stories. Teresa Zilk created Stories to Tell My Daughter, a storytelling series featuring women of color. She does many other things as well, including right now working for COVID Recovery Iowa, which is providing free mental health support for Iowans affected by the pandemic. And she is on the line with me now. Hello, Teresa.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for talking with me. I want to talk about this moment that we are living in right now, which has so many different facets. Of course, the pandemic has affected absolutely everyone. It's an important part of your work as well. How has your family dealt with COVID?
I think we've done pretty well. There, of course, is some degree of worry because I have all of my children actually are considered essential workers. My husband is a first responder. So I think we try and limit how much information we take in because, you know, you have to guard your mental health and just really trying to take care of each other.
Well, and it's you and your husband, your three kids, and they're all grown, right?
Yeah, they're in their 20s.
This period that we're living in, of course, is also not just the pandemic, but we have had this summer of a burgeoning social justice movement that began with the killing of George Floyd, which was such a traumatic moment. What has that been like for you and your family to live through this time, which has been, I can imagine, so many downs and ups as well?
I've said this before, and, you know, the country is shedding its skin. We are shedding our skin, and it is a really, really messy affair. It really is messy. I know this to be something that my ancestors anticipated, even if, you know, none of them, of course, lived to see it. But I feel this is a time that they anticipated. And I was actually thinking about this morning, and I was thinking about all the songs that I grew up singing in church, the really old songs. And I was thinking about the power of those songs. And I remember having a conversation a couple of months ago and saying, you know, maybe those songs don't, you know, maybe there's really no reason to keep singing them. And living through this time, living through this uprising, which is really what it is, I understand the power of the songs, and I understand the energy that they put into those songs. Those songs help you to remain resilient, and those songs carry a message of strength and hope, and they carry blessings, and those are all the things that we need right now.
Can you give me an example of one of the songs you were thinking about?
I was specifically thinking about the song "We Shall Overcome," because I remember saying to somebody, "Oh my gosh, we sing that, you know, we sing that song all the time." And I felt at the time that the song had maybe lost some meaning, but it hasn't. It hasn't at all. And I started thinking about all the other songs that I can remember singing and growing up and hearing, and those songs have power to them. And I'm so ashamed that I was dismissive of that.
How, in watching what's happening right now, which is, you've described as an uprising, There's been so much trauma as well. And I know that you work, of course, in the field trying to bring mental health care to people who need it. How do you take care of yourself and take care of your family through this time? Because, I mean, I know how traumatic it has been for me personally to see what's happening, but I am not a person of color. And for you, the trauma must be so much deeper.
Yeah, racism is exhausting. It's tiring. It's all the hoops that you have to go through. It's, you know, it's maybe you lead a team or you are working with a group of people. You might have to I've been in situations where I've had to constantly talk about my qualifications. I've had to justify my reason for being there, my place. It is, you know, sometimes when I meet people and I might lead talking about, you know, where I got my education from. I might lead even talking about the fact that my husband is a firefighter and a first responder, to put people at ease. That's exhausting. I shouldn't have to do things like that. It's being worried every time my two sons walk out of the door. Something as simple as making sure that I have a receipt for whatever it is that I purchased from the store.
And that's...
Do you have to think about that?
No.
I do.
And that's in addition to
everything else, the just life that is so hard, especially right now.
I mean, it hurts to see someone be shut down in the street. It hurts to see it hurt to see the murder of George Floyd. It hurt to see that. It's painful. So after a while, you learn to turn off the TV, step away from the computer, get off of Facebook, go for a walk. My particular mode of kind of grounding myself is I go and I take a walk out in nature. For me, trees are very healing. And so I like to go to the nearest park, whether that's Greenwood Park or Grays Lake or wherever. And I like to walk among the trees, and I like to walk and walk until I feel better. But a lot of the self-care really revolves around turning off the TV, the radio, whatever it is that you need to do until you start to feel better and kind of feel like you've gained your center again, and then you go back to it.
One of the places that you have found a lot of healing and release is in storytelling, and I want to talk about what you've done to facilitate storytelling from other women in Des Moines. A couple of years ago, you created this storytelling series, Stories to Tell My Daughter.
Yes.
What was the genesis of that? Why did you feel like you could create this space, or should create this space, for women of color to share their stories?
I want to be really specific. And yes, it's women of color, but I had in mind Black women. So part of it was I grew up in the South, and I thought about all the women who had raised me, and all the stories that I kind of absorbed, and all the wisdom that I absorbed from them. I thought a lot about those women. And I thought about people that I knew, just people around me in my community, in my immediate circle, people that I knew. And I thought storytelling was important. I view it as a particularly powerful and cathartic way, to allow or facilitate some kind of healing. Sometimes people need to simply be able to stand up and tell their story. It's not so different than if you go to church. Well, I know particularly in the African American church, when you get up and you give your testimony, and there is something really powerful about being able to give your testimony, tell your story, speak your truth, and to have your community or whomever is present, but to have them bear witness to you. And there is something really powerful about being able to be present and bear witness for someone else.
There are so many different components to that, for the storyteller to have an opportunity to share their experience and to be listened to. But then for the audience, too, to hear something that maybe resonates with their experience or is outside their personal experience.
Exactly.
I would love for you, Teresa, to tell me a little bit about kind of the self-discovery that can happen when you share a story. I know you told a story about your mom, and you found that maybe the story wasn't exactly what you expected it to be in the
yes.
telling.
Well, I'll tell the story to some degree. So last year, I was on the roster for I'll Make Me a World. So I went there to talk about stories to tell my daughter, and to tell a story. And I began telling the story about being a teenager who really all I wanted was to be hip and have straight hair, right? So my mother is old. My mother was old school Southern. So she wasn't letting me relax my hair and do all this stuff I wanted to do. And I grew up in the 90s. So, you know, I wanted to look, I wanted my hair wrapped and I wanted all this stuff. And my mother did my hair at home. She is what you would call a kitchen beautician.
Like so many moms.
Yes. And Saturday was wash day. We washed our hair. We braided it. We did all this. And it felt like it was an all-day affair. And then, you know, she might straighten my hair, press my hair later that night, or she might even do it early Sunday morning. But all of this was in preparation to be ready for church and to be able to, you know, you show up, you're presentable. And so being a typical teenager, I really didn't appreciate any of what she was doing, and I remember she went out of town and I decided I was going to get a relaxer. And that is exactly what I did. I went to the beautician. I got my hair relaxed. It was straightened. I had a cute little haircut. I remember her standing at the stove, and I remember her, you know, she made dinner for me, right? As she always did. And we sat down to eat. And I remember her saying to me, you know, I was tired when I came home, but I knew you were hungry and I was hungry. We needed to eat. So I cooked. And she said, I cooked because I love you. And then she looked at me and she looked at my hair and she said, I do your hair because I love you. I felt kind of bad, but not that bad, right? As I reflected and I was telling the story, I realized that my mother, like so many other mothers, gave up all her Saturdays just for me, right? So you're busy running a household. You're busy doing all, trying to have a life, and you've got kids. And at 16, I didn't get it. I didn't understand. But she died last September. And so I think it was in January when I was at I'll Make Me a World and I was reflecting on all of this. I was so grateful. At 16, I couldn't be grateful. But in my 40s, man, am I grateful.
Yeah. So sometimes stories can lead us to a revelation like that.
Yeah.
It's not always going to be that powerful, but why do we need to listen particularly to Black women right now?
Storytelling is powerful because it allows you to stand in someone else's shoes through their lived experience. It's important to be able to do that because what it allows you to do is to feel empathy. And right now, we are at this point in history because there has been a major lack of empathy. And Black women deserve to be listened to. There has been such erasure in this country, when it has come to the presence of Black women and the voices of Black women, one of the most powerful, I think, voting blocks has been Black women because we don't just go to the polls for ourselves. We take everybody else with us. We bring the issues of our friends, our family. We think about it. We read. We get educated. And the voices of Black women need to be listened to. Black women helped birth this nation. Literally, we helped to birth this nation. We helped to build this nation. The White House would not be standing without Black women. And I know somebody probably is going to disagree with me, but I don't care. I really don't care. This country would not stand without Black women, without the work that we have put into the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the movement now, the social justice movement now. It's being propelled, and it is due to the hands and hearts of Black women.
Teresa Zilk created Stories to Tell My Daughter, a storytelling series featuring women of color. She also works for COVID Recovery Iowa, which is providing free mental health support for Iowans affected by the pandemic. In a moment, I will talk with Des Moines-based rapper and entrepreneur Marcaeus. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices on Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. This hour, I'm talking with Black artists about the power of creating and sharing art. And my next guest is Marcaeus. He's not only creating powerful art, he's an entrepreneur with his own whiskey brand. He's creating opportunities for other artists in Central Iowa, and he has added political organizing to his already full schedule. His Black America Forum is coming up on November 1st, featuring Republican and Democratic candidates. We are going to start our conversation with music.
My shadow from the moon fills the floor. Since the energy from my enemy, I could feel more. Process their tactics, let them feel that they scored. Gather all of the assets, it's a skill to war. You never rush, know that you gotta build for war. Losing equity is worse than getting killed in war. Look, in the midst of chaos, there's opportunity. And opportunity multiplies when you grab it.
That is a little bit of Art of War from the EP Burn the Boats, and Marcaeus is with me now. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you about something you said this summer. You were involved in organizing a Juneteenth festival that so many Iowans had the opportunity to participate in virtually, because, of course, it was in the midst of a pandemic as well. But one of the things you said at the time was that Iowa is one of the worst places in the nation to be born Black. Tell me more about why you believe that's true.
Well, it's that interesting thing, I think, and I have that unique perspective because I wasn't born here. There's a mentality that exists here in Iowa, within the business community, where there just isn't a value for the Black intellect. There isn't really a value for what our culture and the impact it can have on the economy. And so as a result of that, you have a people who are already devalued, like more devalued. And, you know, when you look at some of these statistics even that deal with Black economics, you know, a lot of times they're double worse for Iowa. These are symptoms of some of the systems. It's like some of the systemic things that exist here.
You, as you said, you weren't born in Iowa. You came here to go to Iowa State University, and yeah, you stayed. Why stay?
See, this is something I noticed when I was in college, right? Like, I was in the right circles, in the right fraternities, in the right professors' offices, doing the right things, getting the right A's on the papers. But that still wasn't leading to the same opportunities that I saw leading to people who had worse accolades than I did.
Mm-hmm.
What I did notice was the amount of opportunity that there was. So I had to rap so that I could pay for like living, you know what I mean? And so as a result of that, though, I built a following, and I built a following of people who understood and felt those frustrations, which kind of allowed me to dictate what products and what things and that I could introduce to the market. And so from one standpoint, it was great because there wasn't, because of the lack of resources, I didn't really have any major competitive points. Like, I didn't have to deal with a Sony or a Interscope or anything like that. I was able to just, you know, carve that niche out. But it's on the other end of that, if there wasn't so many roadblocks here, I'd probably resemble more of a Master P than a Marquez, just because of the common sense things that would have happened just within the business sector for me existing here. And of course, it's kind of happening now with the liquor and with some of my other ventures, but it shouldn't take 10 years of proving to get in the door, which is something that you kind of see here.
I want to focus on you as an artist for a little while. Obviously, you have a lot of elements to your career and who you are. But music has been such an incredibly powerful part of Black culture in the United States and a powerful part of social justice movements through the decades. When you think back to when you were younger, what moved you? What music helped inform you and resonated with you?
Oh man, that's a great question. I mean, I think for me, a wide range of things. Like, you know, I was into the Nas. I was into a lot of the old Motown type of vibes. I was into Black Sabbath as well. I was into kind of a diverse mixture of things. The Last Poets, a number of things. I mean, I think for me, one of the things that was that I think pushed my mind forward was actually listening to gangster rap, listening to the hip hop and listening to the music that is supposedly toxic or, you know, poisoning our community, but really taking it from the guise of this is the news. This is a real account of what's happening, of what's not being reported, of what people are seeing, of what they're experiencing, what they have to do to even be participants in the economy. That's the beauty of music, is it can make you aware of different perspectives that you may not have had before.
You talk about gangster rap and really the anger that has caused a lot of people to label it as toxic. But, well, A, I think most of us go through angry music phases in our teens. Also, it's an outlet to express emotions and experiences in such a powerful and authentic way, and in a way that people may not feel comfortable doing face to face. But, you know, somebody can stand up on a stage and bare their soul and tell their story.
And here's the thing, most of the vilification that you see that comes towards we can just probably use hip hop in general, stems from a lot of these issues that we're talking about economically. It comes from you think about it, Charity, look at it like this. The drugs, the guns, the things that are flooding into our community, you now have young Black men and women who are able to take that stuff, tell a story about it, whether participating or not, tell a story from that and become economically successful. That is the exact opposite of what the plan was in putting those tools and those problematic things in our communities in the first place. It's a roundabout issue, you know what I mean? And so a part of and these are things that we look at. Blacks in America earn 59 cents to the dollar of what every white household brings in. You know, that comes out to $29,000 a year. Like, that's massive. Like, the power of music for a Black artist to be able to literally create wealth, it's incredible. It is literally the American dream. It's honestly the same energy that you get from soul food. You know, we're given scraps, we're given the nothing, and turned into something that's actually palatable, turned into something that's profitable. That's the nature of music and culture. You understand? And so driving those things and then tying those things into our economic plight and tying those things into products that can create jobs and infrastructure and fund the right politicians to represent us, those are the things that I think my generation, specifically of musicians in hip-hop, are spearheading.
You started rapping when you were, what, 14, 15 years old?
Yeah, battle rapping, freestyling. For Walmart cards and just, you know what I mean? Silly stuff. Like, yo, it was crazy, yeah.
What ignited that passion in you? What drew you into that world?
For me, and this was a personal thing. In our culture and in mainstream media, there's an infatuation with a docile Black man. Hip hop was one of the few places that I saw for Black men and women to go be free, speak their minds, make money, own everything that they do, and not compromise their community. For me, even early on, the ability to artistically say whatever it was that I felt and be appreciated for it, it was incredible. I remember being like 8, 9 years old watching Tech N9ne perform at like gas stations, like jumping around, dancing out in front of gas stations, my mom pulling my hand like, no, come inside, he's a devil worshiper. But now watching him be on the Forbes list, watching him employ hundreds of people, like that's the energy. And now me being on like the mini version of that, you know what I'm saying? It's a conduit for not only Black creativity, but Black economics. And so I spotted that at like 14 to 15, you know what I mean? Just that this is probably going to be the way to go.
Hip hop is so universal now. And of course, you know, we've seen this with Black music through the centuries. We saw jazz become, you know, wildly popular and co-opted by a lot of white artists and shared by a lot of white artists. And we've seen the same thing again and again. But hip hop there's so much, and of course not every hip hop song, but you know, there's so much information and storytelling that is that's carried in that music. I have to believe that that's a real force for building empathy among all the listeners.
It is. I think, but even beyond that, I think it's a great foundational piece for the people that it's for. You know, if hip hop is used in a way, and this is with any type of music that's used properly, hip hop can be the music, can be the catalyst that carries a movement like we're in right now. It can be the catalyst that funds a movement like we're in right now. Like Sunday Supper, all the things that I'm doing, even starting a liquor line, I wouldn't have had the money to start that liquor line had I not chosen to express myself.
Well, and for people who don't know what it is, what are the Sunday Suppers?
Yeah, so Sunday Supper is a weekly talk show. Comes on every Sunday at 6 p.m. via DSM TV and YouTube. It's about an hour long. We have open discussions about everything affecting and afflicting our Black and brown communities and our communities as a whole. It's also a show where, and this was one of the main things that where we started, we wanted to provide a path for white allies and non-Black people who wanted to support this movement to get involved. What are some clear-cut things that you can do to help? And as with the Sunday Supper, a lot of those conversations end up going towards Black economics. But the best way that we can facilitate this growth and facilitate a movement and an ecosystem that is beneficial for our entire nation is to reinvest into Black economics. Like we look at things like Blacks own less than half of the homes in America. We are at a 42% clip of home ownership compared to 73% for white Americans. Like that's the type of stuff that we are addressing. Those are the type of things that we need to spearhead. It provides opportunities for white businesses and businesses alike who want to just see that flourishment in our community to get involved. And for listeners who they're watching everything on the news, they don't really get it, you can hop on, you can ask a question. And what's awesome about it, it started out with like 2,000 or 3,000 viewers, and we were like, oh, that's awesome. And now we're at like 6,000 to 8,000 viewers an episode. And so the community is tapped in. I think it's just time to continue having these constructive conversations, which is something that's missing, I think, from the dialogue right now in our society.
I mentioned earlier there are many different facets to your career and who you are as a musician, as an entrepreneur, and you've also become more and more politically active in really helping to organize candidate forums and so much that you're doing right now. And we could probably talk for several hours about all of the different things, but can you give me your vision? You are spreading yourself in a lot of directions, but you seem to have a vision for the kind of Des Moines and the kind of Iowa that you think we could become.
You know, it's interesting. I was just having this conversation with Justin the other day, Justin Lewis, and a handful of others. My vision, and I wish I could go into further about some of the other things I've got going on here. It's just a little too soon, but Iowa has the potential to become an economic black hub nationally, and I can see that. It could become a hub of black farming, black economics, new startup businesses. Iowa has that opportunity to be an incubator for black businesses, but not only an incubator, but a foundation. Like, Iowa has that opportunity to really be a modern black Wall Street, to really facilitate a black economy that not only has support from within itself to be able to, you know, self-fund itself, real estate, hospitals, you know, energy, everything that affects the traditional segments of an economy. We're going to be able to see and create those things here and be able to not only support ourselves, but add to the existing infrastructure. I mean, I think there was a report the other day about, you know, with if we were to invest into the black economy in America, generate between $16 to $19 trillion. Imagine, just let's not even throw wild numbers. Imagine if a thriving black economic hub in Des Moines, in Iowa, generated an extra $20 to $30 billion for the state of Iowa. What would happen to Iowa? What would that turn Iowa into? And that's, I think, what spearheads a lot of these conversations that I have with white business owners, Jewish business owners, and every non-black person and black person. When you look at what Iowa could become economically as a whole, stripping race and all that outside of it, if we just come together and just do the common sense, practical things, Iowa could spearhead the American economy. It truly could. It's just a matter of us executing on these things now. It's a matter of us properly allocating these resources in a way where non-white businesses and non-white investors, et cetera, are able to access some of the same things that their counterparts are able to, because it's a mutually beneficial system. We all grow from that. Even from a microcosm, like, you look, I now have more money to throw events. That means I can hire more stage people. I can hire more sound guys. I can hire more, you know, it creates a chasm and a domino effect of just economic boom. You know, and so I don't mean to rant. I get really charged up about this, but I really feel that I was in that unique position to be able to just spearhead something that has never been done. And it's just up to the right leadership and the right implementation of these plans to bring it to fruition.
Marcaeus, thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. I love the opportunity to tell people the truth, because there's not enough of it.
Could end up working for the game like Jimmy Hinchman. You could be a boss and have plenty henchmen.
Marcaeus is a rapper and entrepreneur based in Des Moines. He is also organizing the Black America Forum, featuring Republican and Democratic candidates on November 1st. This has been Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. You can listen to episodes you've missed through our Talk of Iowa podcast. You can also hear a special bonus interview. IPR Classical's Jacqueline Hallbloom talked with world-renowned opera star Simon Estes, who grew up in Centerville, Iowa. He's also written a letter to young Black Iowans. You can find that on our website at iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.